the Magna Carta edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Magna Carta turns 800. The impact it's had. The difference between common law and civil law. And privacy is dead. What are we going to do now? Let's begin episode 300.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of stars. We are away from the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Dawn, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week starts off with a nod to the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta, one of the foundations of our legal system. And I bet you know very little about it. So to rectify that, here's a bit of web wisdom about the history of the Magna Carta.
It's the 15th of June, 1215. This is King John of England, and he's been cornered by all of these angry barons.
I'm so angry.
Me too.
These barons are angry because they are fed up with King John's unfair but holdover. We're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's back up. Whoa, hey, that's a bit too far. That's more like it. Here's medieval England. And in medieval England, society was organized under the feudal system. At the bottom were the peasants. They farmed land that they had rented from the barons. The barons were wealthy because they'd done a favor for the king, who'd given them land as a reward. At the top was the king. He owned everything in the kingdom and could do as he pleased, including making people pay tax.
I hate that.
It's so unfair.
A king's power was based on the belief, supported by the Pope and the Archbishop of Canterbury, that God himself had made the king the king. A king's power also depended on the size of his empire. Anyone understood this? It was Henry Plantagenet. He set out to make a massive empire. He inherited some land in France, but he wanted more. The province of Aquitaine in the southwest of France belonged to Eleanor.
Behind every good king is a lady with a lot of land.
When Henry married her, his domain grew by leaps and bounds. And then, when he became King of England, his empire grew again. So did his family. Henry and Eleanor had 8 children. William, Henry, Matilda, Richard, Geoffrey, Eleanor, John, and the final one was John. Poor John. As the youngest son, it was unlikely that he'd ever be king. But fate has a way of changing everything. When Henry II died, Richard became King of England. Richard spent barely any time in England. He was off fighting the Crusades or battling rebels in France. In 1199, while trying to take a castle in Chaloux, Richard was wounded and died. So despite the odds,
yippee, I'm king.
John was crowned King of England.
Hello, peasants.
Not only did John inherit a really big crown, he also inherited a lot of worries. Number one, he needed to expand and protect his father's empire. Number two, King Philip II was a huge threat to John's empire in France. Plus, he wanted to invade England and install his son, Prince Louis,
Bonjour.
As king. Number three, Pope Innocent III wanted to appoint Stephen Langton as Archbishop of Canterbury. King John wanted to appoint his own archbishop. So the Pope forbade everyone in England from holding religious ceremonies for 5 years. The argument ended when John got scared that Philip was planning an invasion. John needed the Pope's help to stop Philip's invasion, so he paid a massive tribute. All was forgiven, literally. And Stephen Langton became Archbishop of Canterbury. And finally, John had to worry about the barons. He needed their support.
I've had quite enough of this. The king wants far too much money.
Spinach, pah.
But the barons were fed up. In 15 years, King John had lost almost all of his dad's land in France. And he treated his barons very badly. In July 1214, he decided to attack Bouvines and lost. That's when the rebel barons started plotting.
The king is hiring an army.
We need to
He's preparing for a civil war.
Let's meet with him. Let's confront him.
They tried meeting with King John, renouncing their allegiance, even capturing London. But again and again, John ignored them. The rebel barons even considered asking Prince Louis to become king.
Bonjour.
This got King John's attention. And in June 1215, the rebel barons arranged to meet him in neutral territory, Grognewood.
You have no choice.
King John had no choice. He accepted the barons' demands and put his royal seal on the Charter of Liberties. He pretended to go along with it. Secretly asked the Pope to do something. Then he waited in Dover for a response. Meanwhile, scribes made copies of the charter and sent them across the kingdom. Rebel barons also took possession of some of John's castles, including Rochester Castle in Kent. In September, a letter arrived from the Pope.
We, on behalf of Almighty God, utterly reject and condemn this settlement. We order that the charter be null and void of all validity forever.
But this did absolutely nothing to change the rebel barons' minds. So John started a rampage across England.
Esme's war.
You are lousy.
First, Rochester. He destroyed Rochester Bridge, then attacked the castle. After 7 weeks, the barons surrendered. Meanwhile, Louis arrived in London. The barons swore allegiance to him. Now the only thing standing between Louis and the throne of England was the head wearing the crown. In October, John hurried towards Lincoln. He started feeling unwell. In his haste, he crossed the Wash before the tide gone out. His baggy train got stuck in quicksand. All his treasures were lost. By trying so desperately to hold on to the crown of England, he somehow lost it to the sea. John got as far as Newark, broke, alone, and sick with dysentery. King John died. So then John's son Henry became king. He had to be crowned with a plain gold ring.
Hello there, I'm King Henry.
The fact is, the English barons preferred a boy king over a French one.
What? But I thought I was going to be the king.
Au revoir,
Louis.
Bye.
Ciao, ciao.
Especially since they would be in a position to advise him. Still, the country was a mess. So William Marshall, Henry III's main advisor and regent, reissued the Charter of Liberties as a royal charter to assure rebel barons that the new king would keep their demands.
We've removed the really troublesome clauses.
It didn't quite do the trick. So in 1217, William Marshall reissued it for Henry as part of the peace treaty to end the Civil War.
So how did the Charter of Liberties become Magna Carta?
When the Charter was reissued in 1217, it had a second part, the Charter of the Forest. The Charter of Liberties was on a bigger sheet of vellum, and so it became the Great Charter. In Latin, that's Magna Carta. And that's what we've all called it ever since. In 1225, Henry III needed to raise taxes.
No new taxes! No new taxes!
Which raised a few eyebrows. So to prevent another rebellion, he reissued Magna Carta again.
I issue this Magna Carta of my own free will.
In 1297, Henry's son, Edward I, had the same problem.
I need more money to fight the Scots and the Welsh and the French.
And the same solution. This Magna Carta was entered into the statute rolls as English law, which meant that if a king wanted to change it, he had to get it approved by Parliament.
What's the big deal about Magna Carta anyway?
Well, in England, Magna Carta was the first step towards building a fair society where everyone has equal rights and nobody is more powerful than the law. This is the root of our legal system and government. Magna Carta and the English legal system became a model for other countries, including the USA.
Thank you, Magna Carta.
Australia.
Thanks a lot, Magna Carta.
New Zealand.
Cheers, Magna Carta.
Canada.
Thanks, Magna Carta.
And India.
Thanks, Magna Carta.
To name just a few. In fact, if our calculations are correct, one quarter of the people in the world live in a country where the system of government was inspired by Magna Carta. And Magna Carta has inspired the idea that all humans everywhere deserve equal rights and freedom. After the Second World War, the United Nations decided to do something to protect the rights of everyone on the planet. Eleanor Roosevelt and her team wrote the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was approved in December 1948. She described it as
a Magna Carta for all mankind.
After that, countries around the world made their own laws to protect human rights.
Is that where the story ends?
Not by a long shot. Magna Carta was only the first stepping stone on our journey to a fair and just society. Over the past 8 centuries, all sorts of people all over the world have been inspired by Magna Carta to live lives, make laws, build countries that celebrate the idea that everyone is equal under the law. It's a remarkable legacy that's been passed on to us. We are all responsible for making our society fairer and more just. We are all responsible for protecting human rights. And now that you know the story of Magna Carta, it's your responsibility too.
Okay, great history. But it didn't mention, although it did show, sorry there are some limitations to radio, that the Magna Carta was the foundation of other landmarks of legal history, such as the Liberty of Subjects Act of 1354, the Petition of Rights in 1628, which restricted arbitrary taxation, imprisonment, and martial law. Then there's the famous Habeas Corpus Act of 1679, which prevented unlawful or arbitrary imprisonment. That is, you had to be accused of a crime before being locked up. Something Harper has just done away with his recent crime bill. Then there's the Bill of Rights of 1689, which basically created a constitutional democracy, which in turn inspired the U.S. Bill of Rights. And we'll end our sort of historical thing with the Great Reform Act of 1832, which set down the principles, if not the actuality, of universal suffrage and made Parliament an effective democracy, removing things like rotten boroughs and the rights of the aristocracy. So let's listen and learn more about the Magna Carta.
This is the story of an 800-year-old medieval document known as Magna Carta, or the Great Charter. It's one of the most famous documents in the world. But how did this old piece of parchment become such a powerful symbol of our rights and freedoms? Magna Carta was granted in 1215 and established for the first time that everyone, even the king, had to obey the law. When Magna Carta was printed for the first time, it became the first law that all English lawyers studied. But many people didn't realize its significance. Shakespeare wrote a play about King John in which he failed to mention Magna Carta. In the 1600s, English lawyers used Magna Carta to challenge King Charles I. At this time, the king could ignore Parliament and imprison anyone who opposed him. Inspired by Magna Carta, Sir Edward Coke wrote the Petition of Right, which set out to limit the king's powers. Around the same time, Magna Carta was taken overseas to America by the first British settlers. Many American colonies based their own laws on Magna Carta. Then, in the 1770s, the Americans fought for independence from Britain. Magna Carta became a symbol of American liberty, and its principles were echoed in the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights. In 18th century Britain, Magna Carta was used to protest against the censorship of the press. At this time, people could be imprisoned without trial for criticizing the king. When newspaper publisher John Wilkes was arrested for insulting King George III, he used Magna Carta to fight for his freedom. He claimed that ancient English liberties were under threat. Wilkes's campaign showed Magna Carta on everything from posters to teapots. You could say that Magna Carta went viral. In the 1800s, very few people had the right to vote in Britain. A nationwide movement of working people known as the Chartists, inspired by Magna Carta, created a people's charter to fight for all men to have the vote. Then, in the early 1900s, the suffragettes used Magna Carta to argue that all women should have the right to vote too. Increasingly, people across the empire argued for rights equal to those of British citizens. Gandhi fought successfully for greater freedom of Indian settlers in South Africa. He described the resulting document as the Magna Carta of our liberty in this land. In his famous speech from the dock, Nelson Mandela declared his admiration for Magna Carta and for Western democracy, which he contrasted with the oppressive South African regime. Perhaps the most significant influence of Magna Carta today is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Written after the atrocities of World War II, the Declaration states that people around the world are protected by fundamental human rights, regardless of their citizenship, race, gender, or beliefs. Eleanor Roosevelt famously said that the Declaration may well become the international Magna Carta of all men everywhere. Although very few of Magna Carta's original clauses remain valid in English law, it continues to inspire people worldwide. Not a bad legacy for an 800-year-old document.
Hope you enjoyed that. We're going to be right back after this break.
Did you know that the UBC Bookstore collects food for the AMS Food Bank? If you would like to contribute, please bring your non-perishable food items to the bookstore and drop them off in the box near the front cash area. For more information, check out ams.ubc.ca under Services.
And we're back. So let's shift gears a little. Here's a talk presented at the Deconstruct Conference last year. This is Tom Scott's lecture entitled, 2030, Privacy's Dead. What happens next? Let's listen in.
So in the very first talk today, Warren Ellis said that predicting the future was a mug's game. So there's been enough history today, let's try and predict the future. You don't really notice change happening. Google was incorporated 16 years ago yesterday, 1998. The easy access to information that it ushered in changed the world. And sure, if it hadn't been Brin and Page, it would have been someone else with a similar algorithm. But can you imagine taking someone from 1996, never mind Victorian times we had earlier, just 1996, and showing them today? A small little magical device in your pocket that can answer 99% of all your questions about the world and 99% of all your requests for media. But that reports your location to the police constantly so they can look you up if you need to. And then you've got any number of instant ways of communicating with people around the world, nearly anyone in the world, all of which is monitored all the time by shadowy government agencies. Would they think we're in a dystopia? Would they think we're in some sort of utopia? Well, it'd be somewhere in the middle. So let's plot a line. Let's plot a line all the way over here. All the way over here is 1998, the founding of Google. Right here in the middle is where we are now, 2014. Let's see what someone from 1998 would think about today, because what I'm going to do is go about 16 years into the future, into 2030, and let's say that we have roughly the same orders of magnitude increase in access to information. Let's propose some slightly fanciful technology that is about as fanciful as Google would have been all the way back over there. Let's do a talk from Deconstruct 2030. And it would start a little bit something like this. Teenagers are becoming telepathic. Privacy is dead. And we're in another tech bubble. Welcome to 2030, or at least one possible 2030. For the less technical folks in the audience, it might be a little bit difficult to work out what is in the heads of 30s teenagers walking down the street, earbuds in, throat mics on, muttering to themselves constantly, emotions flashing across their face faster than seems reasonable. And anyone who joins an engine network right now with no prior experience will find it overwhelming. It takes about 4 or 5 days of constant access before your brain starts to get used to the enormous tidal wave of data that hits it every single second. Most people, particularly those over the age of about 30, will give up within about 4 or 5 minutes. But there's a reason you hear testimonials from the people who've stuck around about slowly becoming telepathic. What we have today is a confluence of two things. First and foremost, engines. Lin and Xiaoming's paper, now legendary in computer science. It's difficult to remember now just how difficult it was to get information before Ganymede came along. In the early days of Google, the same as the early days of Ganymede, it wasn't intuitive. It was a difficult process. You forget now that originally you had to actually type. You had to spell things correctly. You had to load the right data. You had to give it the right hints and ease it through the first stage of the process so Ganymede and the other engines could kind of work out what you were asking for. It wasn't intuitive. It was something that, like typing, that you just had to learn. Okay, you don't have to learn typing anymore, but once upon a time, that was important. But it was still a light speed leap forward. Before Ganymede, if you wanted to go out with your friends to a restaurant, you wanted to find somewhere, you would have to open one app to find a restaurant, and then you would open a second app to see if it was any good and to see if it met your dietary requirements and your budget, and then you would open a third app to see if there was a table. I mean, more than that, you might actually have to use an old school web page, if anyone remembers those. Well, you could try and wing it, of course. Plenty of people did, but if you wing it, you are likely to be disappointed. And no one's disappointed anymore. Ganymede, and later the other engine's ability to take petabytes of images, text, video, anything, and to infer truths, to infer patterns, to infer faces and dialogue and anything from them in real time, that was a jump on the scale of the mass printing press, on the scale of Google. No one believed in the mid-90s that a search engine could realistically pull in results from the entire web and send them out in real time. Not realistically. Couldn't be done. In the mid-10s, no one thought that a search engine could realistically answer questions like, where should we eat tonight? Not pull in the meaning of we and eat and work out what you're actually asking. And yet, here we are. Ganymede allowed that orders of magnitude increase in access to information. Lin and Xiaoming had the perfect combination of philanthropy and business acumen. They released the engine algorithm as open source. That's what sparked the engine explosion. That's why throat mics actually started working. But they kept their then incredible exabyte of structured data, of inferences, of patterns to themselves and to their company. But that on its own doesn't explain the muttering teenagers. The second part of what we have today is, it's more a social change, really. One of the key points about engines is that the more open you are, the more information you give them, then the better they are. That's why those of us who remember privacy don't really get as much out of them. I mean, yes, okay, we keep throat mics on at work, we take them off when we get home, but the idea of allowing any third party access to everything we say, everything, everyone we meet, everything we do, everywhere we are, is abhorrent. The idea that we should do that is just wrong. I remember clearing my cookies every day. Ask your parents. Now, most of us, we suck it up. We deal with it because the results are worth it. The payoff that we get from being open is worth what we perceive as a cost. But we still take our throat mics off when we get home. I mean, hell, I still use a keyboard every now and again to write code. Some of us still have to, even as typing becomes a more and more niche skill. The only way to stay connected to everyone in your social circle right now, no matter which engine you use, no matter which particular company runs yours, the only way to stay connected to everyone is to be entirely open. That's the only way that the engines know which of your thoughts to send to other people and which should come back. You remember the Facebook newsfeed and later the Twitter newsfeed? You remember the fuss that caused? You remember how it prioritized information that was more important to you? Well, I'm offline right now at a conference, but as soon as I walk off and put my earbud back in, then my engine will start catching me up at 800 words a minute, faster than anyone could possibly speak, but still slow enough for people to understand, for the brain to understand. And it will start catching me up just on the important things, just on the things that matter to me. That's what those muttering teenagers are doing. As they walk down the street, they are talking to 1,000 people at a time, mediated not by an artificial intelligence, just by algorithms. They talk to the world, and the world listens, and they listen back. They are taking part in, I don't know, a giant 20th century chat room, 18th century coffee shop. It's something much greater than the sum of its parts, certainly. I was telling worst-case scenario scare stories about flash mobs back in the 10s, and we haven't seen the start of it. That's the crucial part of engines. You give, and they give back. All of those engines talk to each other. One talks to... The companies that control the engines have data sharing agreements between each other, because it's not a good idea to anthropomorphize these things. If it needs to, the little engine on my phone that I carry in my pocket, it can access the downlinks from the military drones hovering over Brighton, circling 30,000 feet. The outsourced, privatized military drones hovering over Brighton at 30,000 feet. Maybe it needs to guide me past an obstruction. Maybe more likely it wants to magically route me towards a friend. Or maybe it wants to magically route me away from a cluster of people with ASBOs, or whatever ASBOs are called now. Or maybe it just wants to answer my question about finding a pub where I can see the sunset, and no one's asked that question yet. In exchange for me knowing that right now, then other engines from the government and the police can see what I am, who I am, what I'm doing, and what I'm going to be up to. And they know everything about me, but I also know everything about them. Those of us who weren't able to make that sacrifice don't get to use engines. That's not a choice. That's the same way having a smartphone wasn't an option. Neither is not having an engine connection. I mentioned people with ASBOs, by the way. We've We've seen a lot of press about those excluded by the algorithms. Cory Doctorow, who is up next, talked about Wuffy in his book, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, a magical currency based on reputation score. Now, he wrote about neural implants and brain backups and essentially an automated system that worked out what other people thought of you and used that as an actual currency. Bruce Sterling, we heard this referenced earlier, Maneki Neko. It was used as an example of plausible deniability earlier, but it was artificial intelligence that was mediating that, a network that actively attacked people who were trying to bring it down and made their lives very difficult. What we have is so much more mundane than either of those options, so much less explicit. Your engine notices the time that it takes you to respond to things, notices the reactions you have to people, notices who you avoid, and your biases start to get taken on by the engine. And it was designed by engineers in Silicon Valley and Zhongwen Kan, so as Fox News so delicately put it, and I apologize for the accent, well, as some folks it just don't work so well on. Do you remember the racist webcam? Did anyone see that from 2009? It was an HP laptop with an automatic tracking camera. And it wouldn't follow you unless, and I'm quoting here, you had enough difference in intensity of contrast between the eyes and upper cheek. Yeah, it's that, but worse. Because all the implicit associations, all the hidden biases that study after study after study after study have shown are in everyone's heads, they get picked up by engines. The fact that college professors are more likely to respond to inquiries from men, picked up by the engines. It's not clear enough to quantify, it's not clear enough to defend against, it's not one thing that you can pull out of the enormous web of connections and patterns that the engines pick up. And you should have seen the fury when one CEO said, well, that's the way it should be. Engines should reflect the biases of the people who own them. And then what about the people on the other end of the scale? The people who want to be popular or don't want to be popular. We were starting to see sponsored lives back in 2014. Just the very start of it. The people who, I hated the word back then. The people who were vlogging. The people who were talking into their webcam once a day and uploading their lives and their thoughts and their experiences. And kids, teenagers, kids younger than that, were flocking to these people. And old media, television in particular, couldn't understand it. Why would you want to just watch someone talk into a webcam? And they were trying to ask that even as they were updating their antiquated reality show formats to be ever more and more artificial. Saturday Night Entertainment, 2014, BBC One. Celebrities doing acrobatics. No wonder the kids flocked off to YouTube and its successors. And no wonder the advertisers went with them. Streaming live vlogs, of course, have been tried for years. Back in 1996 was arguably the first one, the first real-time feed. That was pre-Google. But the trouble was, with the exception of some obsessives and folks who were happy to watch people play video games 24 hours a day, you still need an editor. No one has time to watch lots of people's entire lives, so you still needed an editor to package up the highlights, tell a story, work out the details, and put it together for consumption. Well, engines can do that, powered by measuring attention responses, constant, automated, A-B testing, and all its successors. They can do that. They did it. Almost everyone born after 2010 is now providing a life log for their friends. And if they're good at it, if they're popular, they're providing it for an audience beyond that as well. No wonder they're the ones getting sponsorship and product placement. And for advertisers, there are no limits on how sneakily or subtly you can start putting product placement into there. The regulation hasn't caught up with it yet at all. And it's notable that there are people, folks in the news, folks who really don't want to be there, they have that audience, even though they really don't want it. There used to be that concept of the A-list celebrity, and the Z-list celebrity, of course, the idea that Hollywood and movies and television and gossip magazines, they were the arbiters of who was a celebrity and who the public cared about. That was the idea, right? You know, you appear in a movie, you appear on television, you are in, you are part of that celebrity. Well, that's not how it works now. Celebrity doesn't work. Celebrity works like the music industry used to. Sure, everyone knows that a folk rock sea shanty band is not going to make the top of the Radio 1 playlist. They're friends of mine. They played Glastonbury. They're really good. But that's fine, because they know that a folk rock sea shanty band isn't going to be there. They're not aiming for that. They're aiming for the portion of their audience that likes folk rock sea shanty bands. They're aspiring to be the greatest folk rock sea shanty band they can be. That's what they're aiming for. That's what their audience wants. And as the music industry always was, they can talk directly to those people. They can get the fans. They can target a niche. That's how celebrity works now. You can target a niche. It doesn't matter. You may never be Hollywood A-list celebrity, but it doesn't matter. Maybe you're more interested in, it's always video games, some form of video game, some specific form. You can aspire to be the celebrity player of that particular genre, and you will find an audience, and they will know where you are, and the advertisers will follow. Of course, we've seen the dangers of this, haven't we? It's Cardinal Richelieu's quote, a supposed quote, give me 6 lines written by the most honest man in the world, and I will find something in them to hang him. Which has never been more true. We've seen modern engine technology used by oppressive governments just as often as we've seen it used to take them down. Yes, knowing the identity of every protester in a mob is devastating knowledge, but it will not stop that mob storming the gates of your palace. If they're already there, it's a little too late. We've also seen what a mob of angry, bitter keyboard vigilantes will do to someone that's offended them, when they really do have access to every aspect of your life. Hiding from abusers, from stalkers, is significantly more difficult than it ever was. There is no off button, no block button for face recognition technology, despite the EU's ham-fisted attempt to force one into law. Politicians have found that not only are their current lives open to detailed analysis, but their previous ones are too. Facebook survived long enough to get its data hooked into engines, just long enough. And of course, your privacy settings don't matter all that much when every tourist photo you've ever appeared in is now available for download as well. It doesn't matter whether you tagged that as removed from this photo, because that doesn't really apply anymore. When all of your users have blanket access and just give it over, well, your life, from the advent of smartphones onwards, is perfectly searchable. I can't even claim I was young. I was like mid-20s at that point. And even if somehow you manage to come through all that squeaky clean without a stain on your character, without a bad picture anywhere, can you claim that for everyone you were ever associated with, everyone you've ever appeared next to? Can you say for every word you ever anonymously wrote on every web forum anywhere that all of those were fine? When IP address logs, which are in the engines, and PROS analysis, which is really easy to do, can trace it back to you with 95% accuracy? We're at Panopticon now. We're there. At least for everyone who lives in a city or uses anything other than the postal service, and that's 85% of the UK population and rising? Have you seen the crime statistics? Pretty much every type of crime is down in the last 10 years. It's not a statistical blip. It's not underreporting. The percentage of crimes being underreported, sorry, the percentage of crimes going unreported has gone down too. And yes, there's a methodology for that. You can look it up. I know correlation is not causation. I know that the two don't go together, but if you go out into the street and just ask people who grew up post-Google, if they would trade everything that the last 32 years has given them for some nebulous concept of privacy, you are going to wait a long time before you find someone who thinks that's a good idea. And if you talk to the kids who grew up post-engines, then privacy is this strange thing that their grandparents believe in. Why wouldn't you share exactly what you're doing? That's just the right thing to do. Imagine for a minute that you are sitting back here in 2014, the day before Lin and Xiaoming released that paper. Nothing seems to have changed for a little while. The last big revolution back in 2014, the last big revolution was Twitter, and that was 8 years old. It's ancient history. There was just enough complacency, just enough thought of stability as they came out of a recession, that they'd gone and got themselves into another bubble. Apps, this time. Smartphone apps. Previously, back then, it was the dot-com bubble, but now, apps. There were companies investing billions in just little toys on phones. They'd never get their money back. They knew somewhere, they must have known they were never going to get their money back, but it meant that their competitors weren't getting that little toy on the phone. And maybe they'd make enough money back with advertising or whatever idea they had that they could start to make something out of it. That's exactly what's going on now. Engines, the engine those muttering teenagers use, has just been bought for $20 billion. It'll last, a couple of years? The investors are banking they can make that money back in that time, and they won't make their money back, just like last time and just like the time before that. But my point is not to complain about people being people and making some poor investment choices. And my point is not to mourn my old-fashioned ideas of privacy, because even back in 2014, that ship was sailing, and it would have taken an incredible effort to stop it. Privacy was already dead, it's just that not everyone agreed with it yet. And my point is not to be someone from the previous generation complaining about muttering kids and their damn distractions. Of course they're distracted. They are part of what may be the greatest thing ever to happen to this planet. My point is this. The dot-com crash, all the way back then, did not kill dot-coms. The app crash did not kill apps. Not the concept. It killed a lot of the individual ones, but we're still using them. The engine crash won't kill engines, but you're sitting here and you think the world is always going to be like this. Everyone does. I do. We've always had engines. At the same time, we've always had smartphones back in 2014. If I think back to my time in university, I had a smartphone then. I just remembered, no, I didn't. I had an old brick of a Nokia because that's when I went to university. But my brain's kind of casually edited in that, of course, we always had smartphones. But here's the thing. It might not have been engines. It might have been anything. It might have been nanotech or biotech or some weird thing I can't think of even now. Predictions of the future never, ever turn out to be true. But that next thing, whatever it is right around the corner. It always is, no matter what year it is. Whatever that next thing is will change the world, and it will arrive so fast, faster than anyone can think, but it won't be shocking, it won't be startling, it won't plunge us into a horrible dystopia or elevate us to a glorious technicolor future world. The same way that our world, right now, isn't really either of those things. Whatever comes next will change our lives, and we have the choice to shape how it'll change our lives, but it will change them. And those lives will, by and large, get a little bit better, just like they usually do. So whatever that next thing is, and whatever year it actually turns out to be, I hope I'm with you to see it.
I hope you found that as interesting as I did. So I'm going to give you a moment to think about what was said, and we'll return after this break.
Stephen Harper's reckless cuts to home mail delivery are hurting the most vulnerable in our society. Senior citizens and those with mobility issues are disproportionately affected by these cuts, all while Canada Post is making millions of dollars in profit. Postal workers are campaigning to protect quality jobs and public services in our communities. The post office belongs to you. Join the fight today at savecanadapost.ca.
Okay, and we're back. So we started with law and we'll end with law. What's the difference between common law, which we have here in most of Canada, the US, and the UK, and civil law, which predominates mostly everywhere else, and yes, including Quebec? I'm going to warn listeners, this is not the most exciting talk, but I found it very informative and much better than any of the alternatives. You might be stunned to learn that whenever I entered common law into the search engine, I kept getting libertarian nut jobs about how common law gave them the right to ignore government and how government is so oppressive, and they can make claims of ownership to, well, almost anything they want. I really wonder what Google must think of me. Anyway, let's learn about the law by listening.
Hello, I'm Professor Claire Germain from the University of Florida College of Law. and this class is part of the Global Students' Introduction to the Law of the United States. Today, we're going to talk about legal traditions, the common law and the civil law. The United States is known as a common law country, but you may also know that most of Europe and Latin America are known as civil law countries. So what do these terms mean, and what does it mean in today's world? The common law and civil law traditions stand out among the variety of legal systems because they are known in countries which are advanced economically and pretty powerful. Now, they also are witness to a lot of history and culture, and they have much relevance today. As you can see from this map, this color-coded map from the University of Ottawa, in blue, you can see the common law countries, starting in England. Then you can see Australia, New Zealand, the North American continent, the United States, and Canada. And then you can see in blue, or part of blue, part of Asia, part of Africa. The civil law countries are indicated in red, so it started in continental Europe and then was exported to parts of Asia, Central and Latin America, and part of Africa. As you can see from the other colors, you know, there are some countries in yellow which follow the customary legal tradition, some countries which are more oriented toward religion, a religious system like Muslim law, and then finally some mixed legal systems which have inherited features from the civil law, from the common law, from other tradition. So this gives you a rough indication of legal traditions. Now, why is legal history relevant today? A famous French philosopher, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, said one time, "Everything is the sum of the past, and nothing is comprehensible except through its history." For the civil law tradition, which is the oldest one, we have to go back all the way to Roman law. Civil law comes from the Latin, jus civile, which means, in Roman times, the law applicable to Roman citizens. And in what happened in 533, in the 6th century, Emperor Justinian, who you see on this image, who was the emperor ruling over the Byzantine Empire, Justinian commissioned a codification of Roman law called the Justinian Code. And that compilation was kind of lost after the 6th century for a few centuries. But then it was rediscovered in the medieval universities. So starting toward the end of the 11th century in Bologna, Italy, medieval scholars rediscovered the text and started reading it and annotating it, commenting on it, and trying to use the Roman law principles and adapting them to contemporary needs. So what happened was truly amazing, because scholars came from all over Europe. They studied the text, and then they went back to their countries and they established universities. So they established the Sorbonne in Paris in the middle of the 13th century, in 1253. Then they went back to Oxford, to Cambridge, to Spain, to other countries of Europe. And they all, the text was in Latin, they read Latin, they spoke Latin, so it led to the formation of what's called a jus commune, like a common law of Europe. That corpus juris civilis, which became the body of Roman law, as you can see, you have the original text, which is in the middle, and then on the side, you see commentaries, which are also called glosses. And then further, you have additional commentary. And the book that you have here was actually printed in 1522, and it comes from the University of Florida Legal Information Center collection. So it shows you how much admiration the scholars of the time had for the Roman law principles and how they adapted them. So at civil law then, we now know that Roman law was rediscovered in the Middle Ages at the universities, and law was developed as a scholarly activity by professors. So if you're talking about law as an academic subject, You're talking about a rule of law, a formulation of law, which is rather abstract. And it's still the case today. When you study law at a French university, a German university, a Spanish university, you're going to have a lot of lectures. Professors write a lot of treatises. When you want to read about the law, you read treatises. So it's still pretty much a scholarly activity. Let's skip over a few centuries after the medieval times. When the era of the nation state arose, then many countries codified their laws in the 19th century. So these codes were inspired by Roman law principles, by canon law, religious law, and by the natural law movement of the 18th century, law being the product of reason. And that codification movement gave rise to the French Civil Code in 1804, to the German Civil Code, which was more scientific, in 1900. And the French Civil Code served as a model for other countries. And you can see the picture of Napoleon, who was the main architect of that French Civil Code. And interestingly enough, many of these codes were inspired by the organization of the Justinian Codes. So it was organized of persons, of things, of property, of obligations. These codes encompassed the entire body of private law, dealing with the law relative to private persons. Let's turn away from the civil law now and go to the common law legal tradition. The United States is a prototype of a common law country. Its legal system and tradition is based on English law, and the law itself was formulated not in an academic way by scholars, but it was developed on a case-by-case basis by judges. How did that happen? We have to go back all the way to 1066 and the Battle of Hastings. You remember William the Conqueror, who was the Duke of Normandy, invaded England, became the King of England. He imported his strong lords and central administration. And then that's what started the royal courts. And then one of his descendants, King Henry II, Plantagenet, established the permanent royal courts in London. So that was a major factor. So at that time, then, the young lawyers, the law students, the judges read and studied the law not in the universities. There were universities, Cambridge, Oxford, but that was more for clerics, for academic topics. To learn the law, you went to the Inns of Court. So they were where the courts were, and they were called inns because the students stayed. They lived in those courts. They lived in those inns. And they still exist. Today, if you want to be admitted in the legal profession in England, you have to be admitted by one of the Inns of Court, different buildings. Now, at common law, the law, it was born out of procedure. There is the notion of precedent, the principle which states that our authority, if you have a case, it can be, that earlier case can be binding or persuasive on later decisions, subsequent cases. Students were trained at the Inns of Court, and in today's law schools, in an American law school, you learn the law by reading case books, not really reading treatises. The major works of the time were not treatises, but they were case reports. Like, for instance, this book that we have in our collection at the University of Florida, 1577, it's called La Grande Abridgment, which is kind of a mixture of French and English, and it's a case report. When you wanted to present a case in the court system, you couldn't just go to court. You had to have a writ which was authorized by the royal court, like, for instance, here, a writ of trespass, which is one of the forms of torts. So that's also from our the collection of the Florida Library. So no treatises were written in England until the 17th century with Edward Coke, and particularly 18th century Sir William Blackstone, who wrote the Commentaries on the Laws of England, which is really the first major treatise formulating the body of the common law of England. So you see in Europe, continental Europe, lots of treatises, in England, court decisions, and then finally in the 18th century, a major treatise. So two different legal traditions. Now, law is tradition, but law is also language. Now, do you realize then when you watch a movie like Miami Vice, a TV show, or another police TV or movie, many words that you hear come from medieval law French, also called Norman French. For instance, in the modern legal language, you will hear words such as trespass, voir dire, which means say the truth, which is the procedure which is used to select jurors for a jury. You hear grand jury, petit jury, plaintiff, breaking and entering, will and testament. All these words come from through the Duke of Normandy. They come through the French. And then it became part of the legal language of the royal courts during the medieval times. And then it continued up until today's time. Now, just for you to know, the reason there are sometimes two words to say the same thing, like breaking and entering, will and testament, it's because one is English and one is French. And many people didn't really understand that law French. But you know how it is with doctors or lawyers. They like to use terms that are esoteric, that the regular people don't understand. So that was part of it. Now, we talked about these different legal traditions. But today, there is a convergence of the civil law and the common law traditions. First of all, in civil law, the code is built on the fact that it regulates relations among private individuals. But since the industrialization of the 19th century, government has intervened a lot. So there are a lot more legislation beyond the codes. In common law countries, there was not that much government intervention, but now there are a lot of codes. The United States has a U.S. code, state codes, administrative regulations. That's one fact. Another fact is the constitutional review of legislation, which was not common in civil law countries where there was a legislative supremacy. But now there are constitutional courts in almost every country. Another factor is the emergence of supranational legal norms, especially within the European Union. All the countries, whether they're civil law or common law, like England and Ireland, are converging. Their legal systems are converging because of the international norms of the European Union, which is a brand new system which is in effect in these countries. So as you can see, there is also a blurring of the civil and common law traditions as to the results to be achieved in a westernized society. So some scholars are talking now about the importance of calling that tradition the Western legal tradition rather than common law, civil law. However, there are still significant differences in the mentalities, the legal reasoning method, the styles of argumentation, even the general organization and methodology of law, legal education, and judicial process. You're going to hear a lot more about how things are in the United States, and that will allow you to reflect upon your own legal system if you're a student from a different country. Some American and English law ideas that are useful, that are distinct, part of the distinct American culture. The first one would be the concept of supremacy of law, that even the state is subject to review according to constitutional standards. The tradition of precedent, and then also the notion of the trial as an adversarial trial, often before a jury, which is very different from the concept in civil law countries of a more inquisitorial trial led by the judge. In the US, in a common law country, the trial is led really by the parties. There is a clash between the parties. That's how the truth will emerge. So in conclusion, as you can see from our previous